This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also download over at our website at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be discussing global warming, and with me is one of the leading scientists on the subject, Steve Schneider of Stanford. Steve Schneider, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Before we dive into the global warming subject, I know you published a book called Patient from Hell a year or two ago, how I worked with my doctors to get the best of modern medicine and how you can too. How is your health, for one thing?
Well, I'm in full remission from my lymphoma, and that was from applying the principles of good policy for climate to medicine, and that was not an easy sell.
Explain how you applied those practices and policies.
Well, we don't know what the details of the future are going to be. After all, if you want data, what data is there on 2050? You know, none. And there was no clinical trial on my relatively rare cancer. So I said, we don't need to have a clinical trial. We need to have a good understanding of how it works. Let's use process knowledge. And that was a foreign thought to most of my doctors. It took me 2 years to convince them to give me a precautionary treatment, and I'm here now 6.5 years after my bone marrow transplant for a disease which has about 1% of people alive. And I felt, no, it's not good enough that some elite guy who's a professor at Stanford who deals with his doctors eyeball to eyeball because their professors at Stanford get special treatment and not everybody else. So I wrote The Patient from Hell to teach other people how to get the same thing.
So this wasn't just that you were one of those lucky people way out on the end of the bell curve. It had absolutely to do, or you think it had to do directly with your aggressive inquiries with the doctors to find the best path.
I'm virtually certain that it had to do with the fact that we found the best path, because finally now there are other doctors and they're beginning a clinical trial and the preliminary results are absolutely clear that if you have a disease like mine that you can't absolutely get rid of, so if you can't cure it, manage it. So what you do is you take out the B cells. I have B cell cancer by applying a drug that's actually a very clever drug. It's an immunotherapy. It's not a chemo. So your own immune system kills your cancer because you assist it by identifying the cells that are infected, and you do that with a protein that they give you. And therefore, it's about the mildest drug you can do. It's just expensive.
Well, what do you tell lay people who aren't Stanford professors and may not have the chops that you have to stand up to a doctor and say, Doc, you're going the wrong way here?
Well, I get one or two emails a week like that. And, you know, what I do in climate change is sort of the bully pulpit. I go high up and I look down on the throngs and go from the top down. But when you get an email from Aunt Jane, whose niece has got an 8 and a 9-year-old, and she's dying of this cancer and the docs won't give the best treatment, it's really visceral to you. And I advise them not on what treatments to make. That would be quackery. I'm not a doc, but I'm a decision analyst to understand how you make decisions in the face of uncertainty, which is where climate policy comes along. And I tell them how to ask their doctors the kinds of questions which show that the standard treatments just don't work.
Why are the docs clinging to these standard treatments then?
They, like a lot of people in the world, live in a paradigm. They live in their tradition. In fact, I said to them back in the days we were fighting this out 6 years ago, I said, you know, with all due respect to Roberta Flack, I'm not going to have you killing me slowly with your paradigm. Their paradigm is clinical trials, and they basically believe that until you run an experiment with double-blind placebos, we don't do anything. And I said, but there's no data on this disease. It's a rare disease. So let's diagnose how it works, and let's try to come up with some way to manage it while you're doing your clinical trials. And this seemed to them, but that's not science. I said, no, exactly the opposite. That's the best of science, because science has to make predictions before it has certainty. And that's where my life's work in global warming came along, because that's exactly what you have to do to deal with global warming. You can't wait for 100% certainty. You've got to protect our life support system long before we're absolutely certain of every detail of the issue.
And the patients with cancer sure can't wait for the double blind study to come through. Tell me how you got interested in sciences in the first place. Were you interested in sciences as a kid? Were your parents scientists?
No, my parents were more involved in humanities, English, and philosophy and things like that. I was the funny guy in the family. I just found astronomy fascinating, and the IGY, the International Geophysical Year, rolled around, and when I was in the eighth grade, and rockets fascinated me, and we had a patch of woods, which my brother and I called the Deep Dark Forest. It was about a square mile of woods in Long Island where I was growing up. And we used to go in there, and after a hurricane blew down trees and I saw what the roots looked like, it was just amazing. And then one day, maybe I was 9 years old, we went there and there was a fence around our dark forest. And what's going on? Turned out that they sold it off to a developer, and that's now Woodmere Park. So I got my conservation roots the hard way very early in life. And although I didn't remember it until sort of graduate school, it was deeply there.
I'm speaking with Steve Schneider. He's a professor, a climatologist over at Stanford. He's been on the crisis of climate change now for just about as long as anybody else has been in this country, warning people, warning senators, warning citizens about what's at stake. When did you first get an inkling that there was something seriously wrong as far as global warming goes?
Earth Day 1. When I was
1970?
1970. I was a grad student at Columbia and finishing up my thesis. But since I was going to be 26 in 71, I was in no hurry to finish. Many of the listeners will have no memory of that, because at 26, you couldn't get drafted into Vietnam. So while I was doing that, Earth Day rolled around and somebody came to campus and said, dust and smoke can cool the climate. Carbon dioxide could warm it. I didn't believe it. I thought the environment was green slime and Lake Erie burning. Climate, too. So I took the one class at Columbia that existed, and it was at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, where my good friend Jim Hansen now directs, and he was a postdoc there at the time. And his mentor, who became mine, a guy named Ishaq Rasool, taught this class, and indeed it was true. We didn't know warming from cooling in 1970, and I did a summer project for him, and it turned out that we thought cooling was even more serious than warming for a year or two, and then we realized that was wrong, and I had to publish why that was wrong. So by 1975, we knew warming was more likely than cooling, and I first went to Congress to talk about this with the three or four other colleagues that agreed in 76, and we had a really contentious hearing in 79.
Contentious because?
I was on the Carter-Mondale Science Policy Task Force. So here I was, 31-year-old, you know, just all full of myself because they asked me to write a thing on climate change, and Jimmy Carter read it, and they said all the right things. And then because of the energy crisis, he panicked about energy independence, and not without good cause, but his solution was wrong. He wanted to have American oil shale, that is, go use the rocks in Colorado, convert them to oil, but it generates twice the CO2 as just burning the oil itself. So the first hearing we had was called by Senators Rivikoff and Muskie. About six of us showed up, and here I was on the task force for my president, and I have to go and oppose his plan by saying, no, you can't leave climate out of the energy equation. And it was a contentious hearing. That was the very first hearing that I know of in 79 where climate was a major component of energy policy.
Now, it sounds like the contentiousness there was between the administration you were working for and your disagreement with their policy. But a lot of the contention is between industry and the scientists. Did you get a whiff of that at that hearing, or did that come later?
Well, I'd have to go back and re-look it up, because I've had so many bouts with industry over the years that I'd be surprised if they weren't there. In the 70s, we at least had the benefit that it hadn't gotten highly polarized, that Republicans and Democrats, although they had different points of views, were generally cordial. They were not inviting crazies like that famous climate professor, Michael Crichton, you know, who's testified to Inhofe's committees over and over, involved. And they really were pretty straight people. It changed radically. In 1981, a young congressman from Tennessee named Albert Gore Jr. had a hearing because his mentor, Roger Revelle, who also, by the way, was in the 79 hearing, had just had this project with the Department of Energy canceled by the new ideological administration called Reagan. And they canceled it because it was about environmental sciences and social sciences. And they just applied a meat axe. Anytime the word environment and social science occurred, they crossed it off. So Gore called this hearing, and in walked in the Reagan official accusing us of alarmism, of chartology, every cliche in the book, of wasting the taxpayers' money. And that's, I think, what got Al Gore into being a climate champion, because we alerted him. At that hearing was the first time that we had somebody as an opponent who was not a climate scientist. The functionary from the Reagan administration was a political hack. And they were spouting ideology. Almost every hearing I've been to until one run by John McCain in 2003 was filled with this. The climate contrarians, guys from the industry, the Western Fuels Association, which my colleague Paul Ehrlich calls the Western Fools Association, the coal lobby, and all those guys were there. And they live in courtroom philosophy. Not my job to make my opponent's case. We can lie, cheat, steal, and distort for the client interest. And in fact, if we didn't, we wouldn't be good lawyers. And we in science are constrained not to do that. So the playing field isn't level, though sometimes we know more and we're funnier. But it's been like that literally since Al Gore's first hearing in 81 until the election in 2006. In 2007, I went to three congressional hearings. Now the Democrats are back in charge. There were no climate contrarians, and the Republicans were cordial, and I thought I had a time warp back to the 1970s. That's good news.
I'm speaking with Steve Schneider, a professor at Stanford and a leading climatologist who's been warning us all about global warming now for three decades almost. You mentioned John McCain. John McCain has a good reputation on issues of global warming. About 5 years ago, I think Bill McKibben said he was heroic on the issue, I think was the word he used. How important is this election as far as global warming goes?
Well, he was heroic. I was at his first hearing in 2003, and I've been to 25 hearings in my life, and never have I seen what happened at that hearing. Here he is, the chair of his committee, and he's a Republican. And usually people from both parties come in and they read their political statements into the congressional record and they support or attack. What happened was about nine Democratic senators came in to support Senator McCain. And can you guess how many Republicans came?
My guess is zero.
Zero. He was being punished for transgressing against his president and his party's issue they love to hate. So I gave McCain credit for the maverick he claims to be. Now what does he do? He selects this, to be perfectly blunt, ignoramus junkyard dog from Alaska who thinks the world isn't even 10,000 years old, and as their state sort of melts into the Arctic, it's an act of God. And I download the other day the campaign, not speech, the
platform?
No, McCain's acceptance speech. Okay. That's what it was. And I did a control F for those of you who know Word, and that means it's a search for a word. So I searched for the word climate. And you know how many times it appeared in his speech?
Again, I'm going to say zero.
Zero. So I searched for warming. How many times?
None.
Zero. And how about environment?
One.
Not even that. Mm-hmm. Zero. So what happened to John McCain? I guess what happened is somebody told him that he can't win in the Republican Party by dealing with a Democratic issue. I still think he deeply believes it, but these choices that he made to back away from his own positions have me very nervous about John McCain.
Steve Nader, how do you deal with know-nothings, with ignoramuses like Sarah Palin? And then there are even some on the left who are very intelligent people, like Alexander Coburn, who for some reason denies the global warming facts.
Well, I think that it's for different reasons. I think that the right-wing ideologues don't like global warming because if they admitted it was a serious problem, which is the collective footprint of lots of individual corporate and national decisions, mostly greed-driven, then they would have to admit that we have to control it, and the only way you can control it is not by volunteerism, any more than if we had voluntary speed limits and traffic lights. Imagine the carnage on the highways without cops and judges. So you need to have rules, and they have to be enforced. So the ideologues don't like government intervention in private rights, so they deny climate change. The left, on the other hand, some of the left, especially that associated with labor, is very nervous that in order to get ourselves off coal and off making SUVs, it's going to hurt people in certain jobs. And that's true. And I don't know any coal miner or auto worker who makes a Hummer who does it because they want to screw up the climate. But screw up the climate they are doing. So what we need is not to sustain grandfather's line of work, but to provide them with a suitable transition to a much more sustainable line of work. So we need two acts of good governance. We have to protect commons, that is, you know, not have so much climate change, and we have to be fair to people who lose from climate policy. So given that I can understand some spokespersons for labor thinking that there's no way we're going to get two acts of good governance, so they have a vested interest in climate denial, but that's not very good for the planet either.
Steven Schneider, how close are we to the so-called tipping point?
A tipping point basically means that you come up to a threshold, and once you go past it, you can't reverse. It's like going down the hill without brakes. The problem is that we know that there are many such thresholds in nature. There are species that'll go extinct when they reach the tops of mountains and warming drives them off. There may be melting of glaciers that beyond a certain warming. The trouble is we don't know where those thresholds are. And when we add up all the thresholds, it doesn't look like everything is fine up to 2 degrees, and then after 2 degrees, the world turns into a climatic pumpkin. It looks more like a kid's skateboard run. You know how when the kids go in there and they have these jumps, and they start going in, and it starts out mild, and then it gets steep, 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 and then it goes vertical. They jump, and the parents close their eyes. I mean, it's like that. When you put all these thresholds together, you start going up to a very steeply dangerous curve. We don't know how far into that we are. So I have to be honest as a scientist and say we don't know exactly where the thresholds are. What we know for sure is the more we keep on business as usual, the more thresholds we're going to transgress, and some of them, like melting of Greenland, could be deeply irreversible, raising sea level 10 feet on the time frame of centuries. And it could even be several feet in this century. That's the end of a good part of South Florida and many other places. There are 150 million people in this world living within a meter of sea level, many of them in Asia. So nobody can say, oh, well, because it's a century away, it has no impact. Cities are supposed to live more than a century.
And what do you make short-term of this notion? I mean, you mentioned oil shale, you know, back in the Carter days, and that's made a comeback, at least as far as proposals go out in Colorado, and then this moronic mantra, drill, baby, drill.
Well, it was I sat there in disbelief listening to this. What they really needed to be saying was greed, baby, greed, because that's exactly what they were talking about. It was so devoid from reality that what they're trying to do is come up with a pablum so that people can continue to stay on their addiction, which is George W. Bush's word, to fossil fuels and petroleum. And in order to make the world safe for Hummers and SUVs, they're going to go out into fragile ecosystems, and they're going to drill. What they forgot to tell you is that none of that oil will be delivered for at least 7 years. And when it is delivered, it's only going to be percentage points of the total world supply of petroleum, given the projected demands with India, China, Indonesia, you know, Mexico, Brazil joining in. So it isn't going to do very much. except provide a windfall profit to those who go out and explore, because the price of oil is so high, given the demand, that they're going to make money even with a slightly higher cost of exploration in those fragile systems. So we're going to get very little out of it other than making a few special interests rich. And if we put our cars on a diet, we could dramatically reduce our demand. If we had mass transit, we could dramatically reduce our demand much more than we're going to get from drilling in fragile places.
And yet the Democrats went along with the offshore oil drilling.
The Democrats know how to read the polls.
And but so a majority of Americans are just ignorant on that then?
Well, they're also living in denial as well. The people are in denial that there's going to have to be a fundamental change in our personal transportation system.
You said cars on a diet. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's gross beyond belief that for a decade we had a tax break whereby you could write off for a while the full value of the car and then $25,000 on your income tax if you had a Schedule C, meaning you were a business. You didn't have to show that you used it in your business for any car over, I think it was 6,000 pounds. And what was the tax break for an efficient car? So instead of putting in fee baits where you actually have a penalty for the monsters which make us defend the lines of supply of oil and cause a hemorrhage in our transfer of cash overseas to buy oil, we're actually subsidizing the very problem. So the cars are too big and they're too heavy. And there's this myth that, oh, if I don't drive a big car, my family isn't safe because I'm going to win the collision, right? If you're colliding a billiard ball with a bowling ball, you'd rather be the bowling ball, right? But what it leaves out is that these big, high, boxy cars have rollover accidents so often that you're actually more endangered in an SUV than you are in a smaller, more maneuverable car. So you're more in danger yourself, and you're endangering everybody else. This requires some rules to control.
The thing that shocked me, too, is when Congress finally got around to raising the mile per gallon, it's like 35 miles per gallon in the year 2020. I mean, it's just so slow. I mean, we're going to take forever to get a place where most people in Europe and in Japan already are.
Well, they used taxes on gasoline, which they did not do, despite what they now say, originally for protecting the environment. They did it for two reasons. One was to raise revenue. I mean, in Italy, income tax evasion was a national sport. So you had to raise revenue through fuel taxes. But also because they didn't have very much fuel on their own. So they wanted to push the society for its own safety into efficiency. And it worked. In fact, in the United States, after the dramatic price rises in 2008, there's been a substantial reduction in vehicle miles traveled, which all the pundits and economists said wasn't going to happen. It did happen, and people are now not buying the SUVs. So they are price responsive. The trouble was the price happened all at once, and that hurts people. If it were announced in advance, we had 5 years to do it, we'd be able to transition without economic harm. I first testified to Senator Bryan, same Senator Bryan we have now from Nevada. He had a hearing in 1988 on CAFE. And what did the auto industry accuse those of us in favor of these standards of? We were trying to unemploy the workers of Detroit. And they did everything they could. They hired attack dog lobbyists. They paid people off. They blocked for 20 years the improvement in gas mileage standards in their cars. Now the price rises happen in the middle of the Bush administration. People don't want to buy their products. They turn around and buy from Toyota and Honda, who did produce these products, and now they're complaining. These guys didn't shoot themselves in the foot. They shot themselves 3 feet higher and they hit.
I'm talking with Steve Schneider, professor of climatology over at Stanford, who's been testifying and warning us all about global warming for three decades now. Green jobs, is there a possibility that we could employ people doing building a green infrastructure who were building Hummers?
I think we can hire a lot more people, and also in a little bit lower strata in the society, by making them a conservation corps. Oh, boy, does that sound like Roosevelt, right? Is that scaring the bejesus out of the right wing? But in fact, there are so many houses out there where homeowners are paying through the nose as prices of energy rise, that need double pane windows with low E that they can now buy at Home Depot or any of the other popular places, that need better insulation, that need to get their lights redone, that need insulation around their heating pipes. It'll save them more money than their investments. But they don't know how to do it. They don't know what to do. Labor is expensive. So if there were a corps that helps people do that, instead of a TSA alone, we could use a TSA for conservation. And it provides meaningful jobs. It reduces the threat of climate change. It reduces our dependence on foreign oil, and it lowers monthly bills. So it's a win-win, but it requires good governance to get there. I think Obama has actually been proposing that, and I hope that happens. The number of jobs that could be involved in the wind industry, in the solar industry, in proper design of new buildings, that's not so much going to be a core for retrofitting houses. That would be a little more of the construction worker and the engineers and architects. But there's work at every level. And the amount of energy that we need to design efficient cars, to come up with batteries that will be cheaper and work better, that's going to take a lot of industry work. There's plenty of jobs to be had, but we have to transition it, I would say, over 5 to 10 years. Don't try to do it all in 1 year, because then you dislocate people who are used to doing it the old way.
I know Bernie Sanders is talking about or has proposed a bill to get 10 million solar panels on homes or government buildings around the country, and that would be a big employment effort as well, I think.
Yeah, all of these kinds of efforts need to be looked at. But before I would endorse that specific one, I'd want to look at how much climate benefit we get relative to putting solar plants in the desert with direct current transmission lines, which are much more efficient. And we need to go out there, have what I call a learning by doing feeding frenzy. I mean, there are so many possibilities. We don't know what all the costs are. We don't know what all the social acceptability is. We don't know how effective it's going to get. So let's try a lot of things. You know, I'm not into quoting President Bush much, but Bush the first did say, let 1,000 flowers bloom once. And in this case, we need at least 50 of them. And we've got to perform this experiment. Let's have some political courage. Let's try to do a lot of things, and then here's where the market comes along. Let the market try to sort out what works, as long as we collectively make certain that all the options are protecting the common property.
Steve Schneider, we have a little less than a minute left. You're participating in a national teach-in on some of these global warming solutions. It's slated for February 5th. How do people get hooked into that?
Well, Focus the Nation, that Eben Goodstein from Lewis and Clark College in Portland put one together in the winter of 2008 and had 1.5 million kids listening in, hundreds of institutions. So I just go on the web and also look up Goodstein at Lewis and Clark, send him an email, and you'll find out. Get your campus involved in that. Get your church involved in that. Get your political group involved, because we need this grassroots, bottom-up movement that goes along with the top-down government rules.
And I think you can also go to nationalteachin.org. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Steve Schneider, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.